This week, we unravel the mysteries of the Mithraic mystery cults and their relation to Freemasonry. Did Freemasonry spring up on its own? Did Freemasonry grow from seeds planted in the Mithraic traditions? Is Freemasonry a copy of the Mithraic traditions for a modern world? Or are they completely unrelated? Well, for the truth of the matter, we've got you covered in this week's episode in a special Masonic Mythbusters with Worshipful Brother Patrick Day. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 618. I want to thank the producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners of the WCY podcast. Without you all, we can't do this show the way we do it and continue to offer amazing and trusted Masonic education to all those interested in the royal art. If you're curious on how you can support the WCY podcast, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and check out the various options. We've also got an Amazon affiliate bookstore, items for sale, and a whole slew of other things that offer you a good value proposition. I hope you're all doing well and recuperating after Thanksgiving, or if you don't celebrate that and you had at least some good family time, I hope it all went very well. In the news, I just wanted to say that by the time this episode comes out, I will, within 24 hours, probably be installed as the Worshipful Master of Space Novum Lodge 1183. This was not something that was planned or anything. I'm really humbled by that. We'll be covering some very cool Western esoteric topics, but not the typical Western esoteric traditions you may be used to. This year, we're going to be focusing on some Grecian history and philosophy centered around the labors of Hercules. So we'll be exploring that this year. It'll be, I feel, a good complement to our education plan that we ran last year, which Worshipful Brother Adam Hassel took us through many of the concepts of Taoism and how it relates to Masonry and its common ground. So I hope this year will be complementary. In other news, December 19th, I'll be doing a presentation for a local council, a regional council, I should say. More information is available online. You can find flyers and whatnot in and around the various Illinois Facebook groups if you're in them. Or I may have shared it on my own personal Facebook wall, as well as on the Whence Came You Facebook feed. We've got a number of presentations that are already starting to line up for next year, so I'm very thankful. This episode is a pretty special one in that it's going to cover something that I find absolutely fascinating, whether it was Albert Mackey, Albert Pike, the late great Henry Clausen, talking about the mysteries of Mithras, or the Mithraic rites of passage, the Mithraic mysteries, a very curious system, and one that is at least accessible to us because we know so much about it, thanks to archaeology and writers alike. And so usually we read a couple of papers and we've got some segments that we've got some great brothers that come in and do some segments for us. This week we have just a segment. It's a long one, but it's a special one all about the mysteries of Mithras. And it's the Masonic Mythbusters with Worshipful Brother Patrick Day. The question this week is, were the cults of Mithras a precursor to Freemasonry? This is a very hot topic. Brother Patrick Day brings us the facts and the archaeological history and the context and all of those things. So you can take what he says to the bank, guaranteed. So with that said, I hope you enjoy this extended Masonic Mythbusters. Let's check it out.
In a digital landscape filled with historical inaccuracy, out-of-context quotes on memes and soundbites, there is an epidemic of fraternal occult, mythological, and historical misinformation. It's time to set the record straight.
Welcome
Masonic Mythbusters with Patrick Day.
Albert Mackey writes the following concerning the ancient Roman mystery cults of Mithras. Quote, "There are none of the ancient mysteries which afford a more interesting subject of investigation to the Masonic scholar than those of the Persian god Mithras," end quote. While I wholeheartedly agree, Mackey then proceeds to discuss the rites, symbols, and doctrines of the Mithraic mysteries, of which almost none of it resembles Freemasonry in any meaningful way. Manly P. Hall does much the same thing in his Secret Teachings of All Ages, as does Charles Heckthorne in Secret Societies of All Ages and Countries. What truly distinguishes the cults of Mithras and the Roman Empire is that of all the mystery cults of antiquity, the mysteries of Mithras are perhaps the most understood, having the most archaeological evidence and commentary by ancient authors surviving to the present day. In fact, there is so much that many archaeologists have a pretty good understanding of what the rituals were like, how they were structured, and many other activities of the group. Numerous authors of antiquity have written about the cults of Mithras, some telling of symbolic teachings and ideologies such as Porphyry, and we have depictions of their rituals such as the Manes vase and crude frescoes at the Mithraeum of Santa Maria Capua Vetere in Italy. And while Mackey and Hall and other Masonic authors all agree that the cults of Mithras are the mystery religion that is of most interest to the Masonic student, they all seem to be cribbing the same bad information from each other. But there is a lot more known about these groups today than was available to Mackey and Hall, so I won't really fault them for that. And a serious study of what archaeology tells us about these groups will illustrate that these Mithraic cults were probably closer in semblance to modern-day Freemasonry than any previous Masonic author could have dreamed of. Now, does that mean the cults of Mithras eventually became the Freemasons? No, emphatically no. There simply is no proof to connect the two. The cults of Mithras, and really all mystery religions, were effectively stomped out by Theodosius I in the 4th century CE. The first stonemason guilds in medieval Europe spring up in the 12th century. That is almost 700 years of absolutely no evidence whatsoever. Logically, there can be no connection. Furthermore, as much as the Mithraic cults resemble Freemasonry, there is just as many differences between them as there are similarities. In fact, some of the differences are so extreme as to disqualify them as being Masonic at all. Nonetheless, similarities are quite striking, and many are so extraordinarily similar to Freemasonry that it becomes hard to not fantasize how the two could be historically connected. You know, outside of zero evidence whatsoever. So, contrary to whatever Mackey and Hall and whatever that weird esoteric Masonic brother in your lodge said, let's break down the cults of Mithras and compare and contrast them to Mithraism as archaeology understands them. Now, firstly, we need to clear up some things. The cults of Mithras were mystery cults. By mystery, we do not mean like the mysteries of the universe or other mystic concepts. What is meant is that what went on is a mystery. They were so secretive, so that their rituals and their teachings, etc., were lost to the annals of time. We just don't know any particulars of their cult with any certainty, so only generalities may be surmised. And this is why I love the cult Mithras, because a lot of evidence survives, even depictions of their rituals. And there's a lot of written commentary that we know more about them than, say, the cult at Eleusis or the cult of Isis and others. Now, they were not a singular group like the cult at Eleusis or the cult at Samothrake. They were each independent organizations, much like Masonic lodges. This is why I call them the cults of Mithras, because they were multiple organizations. So you can't really treat them as a monolith. And there are, you know, variations between the different groups and different Mithraea. Next, we tend to call the halls where the Mithraic cults met Mithraea, or singular Mithraeum. However, they did not call them this. They viewed their meeting places as the cave where Mithras, in the myth cycle, carried the slain bull to dine with the god Helios. Thus, they called their meeting places Spelaia, singular Spelaium, i.e. caves, where we get the word spelunking. I will, therefore, interchangeably use Mithraeum, Spelaium, and cave. Just FYI. Now, lastly, there is a difference between the ritual and the myth surrounding the cult. This is the dichotomy of the ritual and the myth cycle. Now, all too often, Masons impose their experience of the Master Mason degree onto other ancient mystery cults. Basically, the myth cycle of Freemasonry, that of the Hieromic legend, and the drama enacted during the Third Degree are one and the same. Hence why I actually prefer the term Hieromic drama, as it is, first and foremost, a drama enacted for the candidate, and then there is the legend that follows in the lectures and subsequent writings. But they are mutually linked in Freemasonry. The Masonic myth cycle of Hiram Abiff is inherently tied to the drama, the dramatic ritual of the same narrative experienced by the candidate, but this does not mean ritual and myth cycle are the same thing, and they likely were not linked in many mystery cults of antiquity. We're not totally certain what occurred in the rituals in the Mithraic cults because, well, it's a mystery cult. Though we have some ideas of what went on, just because some of the myth cycle does not mean that part of the ritual, either literally or symbolically, were the same. We will return to ritual elements of the Mithraic cults later. Now, let's look at some of the elements of both the Mithraic cults and Freemasonry and how they relate and are different. The cults of Mithras were civic associations, much like Masonic lodges. And similar to Masonry, it afforded opportunities for certain lower people to gain the ears of influential persons, such as a soldier, to rub shoulders with a general in hopes of, like, say, getting a promotion. In fact, the cults of Mithras were largely military cults, though certainly other occupations would join, but it was largely spread and popularized by soldiers. Now, as a result, a lowly foot soldier was unlikely to serve as, say, the pater of a spelaeum, and might never advance much higher than the grade of lion, whereas a general was much more likely to be Persian, or a Heliodromus, or even the pater grades. Now, Masonry is not like this at all. One's social position does not guarantee nor inhibit their ability to advance in Masonry, or serve as master of a lodge. Though the Mithraic cults were civic associations, they were also collectively a religion dedicated to the worship of Mithras. Freemasonry is not a religion, and some guys get really touchy if you suggest that. Certainly, Freemasonry is composed of men of faith, that is, every Mason is required to profess a belief in deity. But the fraternity does not care who your god is, how many gods there are, how is God doing lately, as long as you believe there is something numinous above and beyond you, then that is all that matters. The cults of Mithras, however, worshipped Mithras, plain and simple. Now, this does not mean they only worshipped Mithras, as Romans were polytheists, after all. It was not uncommon for someone to mainly be devoted to Mars, but also a member of the Mithraic cult, or even a Christian and a Mithraicist. In fact, there were spiritual tourists back then, as there are now. Guys would travel to Greece to become part of the cult at Eleusis, and then they'd head over to Samothrake and be initiated there, and then over to Lemnos for the rites there, and join the cult of Isis, etc. Apuleius, author of The Golden Ass, is a great example of this. Just like there are Masons that have to join every Masonic and quasi-Masonic organization under the sun, I personally like to call them Masonic tourists. They just collect degrees and titles and dues cards, etc. Yeah, this kind of thing has always been around. There are other qualifications and restrictions on admission into the cult of Mithras. Like, in Masonry, a candidate must be a man. There were no women allowed. But unlike Freemasonry, slaves were permitted to join the cult of Mithras, whereas in Masonry, one must be freeborn. Can't be a slave. Now, Mithras is originally a Persian god. Likely he was appropriated by Roman soldiers while campaigning in the Middle East. However, the Roman Mithras does not resemble the Persian Mithra in any meaningful way. In reality, the Roman Mithras resembles Ahriman more than anything. In the Zoroastrian text, Bundahishan. Yeah, I'm not good at pronouncing these things. That was my best attempt. In that text, in the creation of the world, the cosmos was divided between Arimazda, the bright, beneficent deity, and Ahriman, the dark, evil god. Now, Ahriman would slay the primal bull, but the semen of the bull would be rescued by the moon to create animals. Yeah. Zoroastrians are non-violent. They prohibit cruelty to animals and are admonished to respect all living creatures, and so are largely vegetarian, with very few exceptions. So, how did Mithras, a minor Zoroastrian deity, become such a violent god, slaying the bull like the evil god Ahriman, and ritual banquets being held feasting on such a slain bull? Like I said, the Roman cults of Mithras were created and spread by Roman soldiers. This is why Christianity was not very popular in the Roman legions, because Christianity was really a religion of peace, whereas the Mithraic cults were very militaristic and had a lot of violent symbolism. So obviously, Mithraism was, you know, much more appealing to soldiers than Christianity. And as a result, some kind of Roman militaristic transformation occurred with Zoroastrian deities. Mithras becomes more like Ahriman, and the astrological knowledge of the Magi, the Persian priest, gets appropriated into a new Roman religion. In reality, the Roman cults of Mithras are not Persian. They were strictly a Roman religion, just as much as Christianity is really a Roman religion. Remember, Paul was Roman, and he was like Jesus' biggest fanboy. Similarly, Hiram Abiff, as depicted in Masonry, is nothing like the Hiram of the Bible. The story of the Hiramic drama is just, it's purely Masonic, and nowhere in the Bible. It is a myth cycle that is proprietary to Freemasonry, just as Mithras is strictly Roman in conception of the cult. The cults of Mithras were divided into grades, much like the Masonic Lodge is divided into degrees. Degrees and grades mean the same thing. Literally and etymologically, the gree part of degree is derived from the Latin gradus, where we get the word grade. Both words literally mean step. However, the Mithraic cults were divided into 7 grades, while Freemasonry is divided into 3 degrees. Masonry's grade system is derived from the contractual status of the medieval guild system, namely apprentice, that is, one who is under a training contract with a master. Then there's the journeyman, what we call the fellowcraft, who is under a working contract with a master. And then there is a master, one who owns their own business and is free of a contract and can contract others to work for. Now, The Mithraic grade system was symbolically based on the seven classical planets, and have some weird names. So, 7 degrees, not three. And the exact order of the grades is subject to some debate, thanks to conflicting information from St. Jerome, but based on the imagery at the Mithraeum at Ostia and other Mithraea, it is believed the order and the names of the grades were Korax, the raven, Nymphis, which is sometimes translated as bridegroom, though nymphs are female, but it's rendered in a masculine declension, so it's this weird androgynous, like, transgender title, so most tend to not translate it, they leave it as Nymphis. The next grade is Miles, the soldier, Leo, the lion, then Perseus, the Persian, Heliodromus, that is the sun runner, and then finally, Pater, the father. Now, each grade is associated with a planet, which is thus, the raven is associated with Mercury, Nymphis with Venus, Miles with Mars, Leo with Jupiter, Perseus, the moon, Heliodromus, the sun, and Pater is associated with Saturn. Now, here is where Masonry and Mithraicism kind of come together, but also diverge, because Masonry is not an astrological symbolic organization. I mean, sure, the sun and the moon are emblematically present, but there is no other, like, planetary correspondence in Masonic officers. So to assign any would be arbitrary and speculative. I mean, sure, like, astronomy is one of those liberal arts the Masons are encouraged to study, and there are various astrological references in Masonic ritual, but astrology and astronomy are not a primary significance in Masonry. However, Mithraicism is an astrological cult. Astrological significance pervades the entirety of Mithraic symbolism, ritual, and layout of the Mithraeum. For instance, the Mithraeum is situated symbolically east to west, with the main rows of seating on the north and south walls, much like the Masonic Lodge. Like how the Lodge is bounded by the starry-decked heavens, so too do Mithraicists see the spoleum as being vaulted by the heavens, so some actually providing a sloped veneer of plaster, making it appear to be vaulted. Now, the Mithraic cults, they did not sit, they lay down on their tummies. This was how Romans ate, laying down. Roman dining rooms were actually called triclinia, which literally means three couches that they would lay down upon. The fact that the Mithraea are set up to lay down indicates that dining and banqueting were an important aspect of Mithraic meetings. Likewise, dinners are equally as important in Freemasonry. And in fact, in old Masonic rituals, we find that a ritual banquet was a central feature. Yeah, the Mithraicists were kind of like Spaghetti Masons. They were a dinner club. So, don't bash on Spaghetti Masons too much. Because, let's face it, eating dinner is still awesome. We actually have pretty good evidence of what the Mithraic cults ate, as they have, like, they find animal bones being dug up in pits around certain Mithraea, which points to just these huge banquets they would have. The fraters, and they did call each other fraters, or brothers, would lie down in the north and south with a central aisle down the middle from, you know, from the entry to the pater in the east. Now, just like Masonic lodges, Mithraea can be geographically oriented, however is convenient. They don't have to be geographically oriented true east, west, north, south, and they usually don't. But they are symbolically oriented east, west, and this is evident by, in some Mithraea, they have found zodiacs painted on the walls around the room with Aries in the east and Libra in the west, as is customary, with Capricorn in the south and Cancer in the north. Thus, the zodiacs go around in a counterclockwise manner, as the sun moves through the zodiacs in a counterclockwise manner. Now, while the Maitreya are set up linearly down a narrow aisle, the candidates likely being processed up and down the central aisle, they're meant to be mimicking a process that is like a circumambulation in a counterclockwise manner, even though they're going up and down an aisle. It's just a symbolic counterclockwise procession like the zodiacs. And this is argued by Roger Beck, one of the premier, you know, researchers and historians on the cults of Mithras. Now, this is contrary to Masonic ritual, in which the candidate is processes in a clockwise manner around the room. And the usual interpretation is that this is because this is the movement of the sun throughout the day, but counterclockwise procession is still appropriate, as it may be for the Mithraeus, as this is how the sun moves throughout the year through the zodiacs. Many Mithraea have a basin or water feature in the south. It's a little bit to the east of the center of the south wall. This is actually kind of similar in masonry, namely with the sheaf of corn hanging near a water ford. This Mithraic water basin may have been something like a baptism, though such is kind of uncertain. Roger Beck argues that though they had something like a baptism, in the Mithraic myth cycle, Mithras is born from a rock. He's not born of a virgin. I don't know who's going around impregnating rocks, but Mithras is parthenogenic. He's self-born, not virgin-born. Now, later, Mithras will shoot a rock with a bow and arrow. I'm not certain if it's the same rock or not, but when he strikes it with an arrow, it begins to gush forth with water. This is what's called the water miracle. Beck argues, using the Mains vase, that how the candidate may represent the rock in a quasi-baptismal ritual. Now, on one side of the Mains vase is depicted the pater aiming an arrow at a blindfolded initiate, with an orator next to the candidate explaining what is happening. The pater represents Mithras, so in this instance, the candidate is the rock and is about to gush forth with water symbolically. It's doubtful they actually shot anyone with a real arrow. Now, if Roger Beck is correct that this fountain and arrow ritual is indeed a baptismal ritual of sort, this does not actually correlate with masonry. We don't interpret the sheaf of corn in the south as part of a baptism, even though it is curious that Mithraea have a water feature in the south. We view it as an emblem of abundance and plenty. What is weird is that the sheaf of corn represents plenty and is located at a water ford. But a water ford is where the river is shallow and easy to cross, and therefore not plenty of water. You know, even the word shibboleth, as used at the water ford in the Book of Judges, means both ear of corn and torrent of water. So it represents plenty, but also not. No one ever says masonry wasn't contradictory and ambiguous. And the cults of Mithras were also contradictory and ambiguous. This is what makes things fun. Based on descriptions by Tertullian and various images on Mithraic walls, such as those at Santa Maria Capua, we can approximate something of their rituals. The initiand is usually naked and blindfolded. He will be led by a mystagogue clothed in a white tunic. The initiant's hands will be bound behind his back with either rope or chicken guts. The pater, clothed in a red robe and a red Phrygian cap, will approach the initiant with a sword or a rod and point it toward him. The initiant will kneel, and the sword or rod will be placed at the ground next to him. The mystagogue will then lay his right hand upon the initiant's head. This may be the same part in the ritual in which Tertullian tells us that the initiant will be given a crown And then the Initian will reject the crown, saying, "Mithras is my only crown." If you've ever seen the movie The Conspiracy, those dudes did their research on the Mithraic cults. Great representation of a Mithraic ritual there. And they actually interview Roger Beck in that movie. It was awesome. I digress. Another scene, next in the series at Santa Maria Capua, the mystagogue places his hands on the kneeling candidate's shoulders. Beside the Initian is some unknown object, some have interpreted as a loaf of bread, or maybe it is the crown that was rejected. The pater approaches, pointing to the object on the ground. Next, the Initian is symbolically killed, as he is next depicted laying out on his back, with the two mystagogues at his head and feet. Now, where this ritual falls into the grade system is uncertain. It could be the initial initiation ceremony, or some later ritual, or the scenes come from different rituals of grades. The scenes at Santa Maria Capua are truly, truly unique and immensely valuable, and the Mains vase is also really valuable because of its depictions. We've already discussed the side that is perhaps related to the water miracle. Now, the other side of the vase depicts a procession of sorts. It shows a man with a whip, who is perhaps the Heliodromus, leading three other figures. One figure holds a rod, which he raises upward. The other is pointing a rod downward, and between them is a blindfolded Initian. The two figures with rods are kind of like the deacons in a way, in the way they escort and they hold rods. Except instead of the sun and the moon, they represent the winter and summer solstices. Now, these two figures are unique characters in the Mithraic myth cycles. They are called Kaltes and Kaltipates. They are divine twins, and in the larger scheme of Mithraic astrology, they represent Gemini. And they tend to accompany Mithras through his various adventures of his myth cycle. In Mithraic art, and according to Porphyry in his On the Cave of the Nymphs, Kaltes is situated in the south, Mithras is left, with a raised torch and corresponds with Capricorn and represents the winter solstice. Kaltipates is in the north, Mithras is right, and lowers his torch and corresponds to Cancer and represents the summer solstice. That is highly abridged, but if you paid attention, you may have noticed an apparent contradiction. The winter solstice is represented by a raised torch, and the summer solstice by a lowered torch. Shouldn't it be the other way around? We would expect a raised torch to represent the sun at its highest in the summer, and a lowered torch to represent the winter solstice when the sun is at its lowest. Ah, but the Mithraic cults are weird. They look at the process of the sun, not the position of the sun. When the sun reaches its highest zenith on the summer solstice, the sun cannot go higher, and thus begins to descend for the rest of the year. It's not about the sun being at its highest point, but rather the sun has reached the point where it must begin to descend. Hence a lower torch. Likewise, the raised torch represents the sun beginning its ascension at the winter solstice. Now, these celestial twins have a soteriological essence, a formulated ideology of the salvation of the soul. Now, according to Celsus, which is coming via Origen in his Contra Celsus, because the writings of Celsus are lost, the Mithraists viewed the soul descending into the world and into the body through the gate of Cancer at the summer solstice, and descends like the sun descends. Then when the body perishes, the soul will ascend and exit the world through the gate of Capricorn at the winter solstice, just as the sun begins to ascend on the winter solstice. These things all play into the great image called the Tauroctony, which is the great image of Mithras slaying the bull, which is always found on the eastern wall of the spoleum. Just like how the letter G is always found on the eastern wall behind the master of the lodge. this is an immense scene of varying degrees of complexity. Sometimes it's just Mithras slaying the bull. Other times, many more characters and entities are present. Possibly even the myth cycle itself depicted surrounding the scene. It may be painted on the wall, it may be a bas relief, a combination thereof, or even a freestanding statue. The variations of the Tauroctony are as diverse as all the Mithraic caves ever found. At most, we will see Mithras straddling a bull with his right foot on the ground beside the bull and his left knee in the bull's back or side. He is pulling the bull's head back with his left hand and stabbing it in the throat with his right hand. Mithras represents the sun, and the bull represents the moon. This represents the sun conquering the moon, the light conquering the dark, the day conquering the night, Leo the lion, just at the beginning of the sun's descent after the solstice, conquering the spring equinox, Taurus the bull. In fact, at noon on the summer solstice, Taurus has just set below the horizon. This astrological understanding is, represented with Mithras conquering the bull, the sun, conquering the moon, etc. It's fantastic. Now, accompanying this scene, we usually see a raven flying overhead, representing the constellation of Corvus. Blood trickling from the bull's neck, sometimes been interpreted as Aquarius. And as it trickles, it is being consumed by a dog, representing Canis Major and Minor. As well as a serpent drinking the blood, and the serpent representing the constellation Hydra. There is a scorpion clawing the bull's testicles, representing Scorpio. Sometimes there is a lion, being Leo, and a cup, being the constellation Crater, but some have also interpreted it as Aquarius as well. Interpretively, we may presume the knife Mithras uses to slay the bull is Ares with its martial, violent qualities, and that Mithras straddling the bull represents the balance of Libra. The bull's tail frequently terminates as an ear of wheat, which represents the brightest star in Virgo, called Spica, literally meaning ear of wheat. This is why Virgo usually bears a sheaf of wheat. Now, one will note that many of these characters present are constellations, but they are not zodiacs. Rather, they are that band of constellations just below the zodiacal band, such as Corvus, Crater, Hydra, Canis, etc. And then also usually the sun and moon are present overhead to bear witness to the scene. So yeah, the Mithraists are seriously astrological. Like, they take it to the next level. Masons love to construe astrological interpretations of Masonic things, much of which can be totally bogus or just really stretching it. But the Mithraic cults, they are taking astrology and astrological symbolism, and they turn it up to 11. It is indisputable that Mithras is the sun. But the scene of the Tauroctony, Mithras is situated in the middle between Caltes and Caltipates, the summer and winter solstices. This would make Mithras the equinox, a balance between the extremes of the solstices. If that sounds like something in Masonry, you're on the right page. This is the exact symbolic interpretation of the circumpunct bounded by two perpendicular parallel lines representing the Saints John the Evangelist and the Baptists, whose feast days are near the solstices. The Baptists at the summer, and the Evangelists at the winter solstice. Now, the point within the circle, the circumpunct, is the classic astrological symbol for the sun. Here, we have the same symbol with two incredibly different manifestations. One of Mithras, the unconquered sun, straddling the bull, Libra straddling Taurus, the autumnal and vernal equinoxes. They are in the middle, bounded by the summer and winter solstices. Likewise, we have the solar symbol, bounded by the lines of the solstices. Both symbols illustrate balance and moderation and a medium between extremes. And I mean, with that clearly in mind, we may start to look back at similar things in Masonry and see some astrological symbolism. I mean, for instance, the Virgin in the monument to Hiram Abiff may be seen as Virgo. Time standing behind her with a scythe, that's Father Saturn. I mean, that is the classic image of Saturn. The star Spica in Virgo may be related back to the ear of corn in the south. Perhaps the urn the Virgin holds is filled with ashes is the constellation of Crater. Fides or Fidelity may be the faithful dog, Canis Major or Minor. Leo the Lion and the Lion of the Tribe of Judah. I mean, that one's actually not that far-fetched, as it is evident by the banners in the Royal Arch, in which the four principal tribes of Israel are represented by the zodiacs of the equinoxes and solstices. Except note that in Mesopotamia, Scorpio was actually originally an eagle, hence why it's an eagle in the Royal Arch. We can keep running with this, and some things are more speculation than anything, definitive or arguably certain. In fact, we could just be making all of this up, and there is zero astrological interpretation whatsoever in Masonry, but that's kind of doubtful. Nonetheless, one will note that there are some striking similarities between Masonic lodges and symbolism and Mithraic cults. And I like to think that it's just so cool. Like I said, Mackey and Hall say that the Mithraic cults were the mystery religion of antiquity that were of the most interest to Masons, and they were right, but I think for the wrong reasons. I'm not going to get into what, you know, Mackey and Heckthorne and others said about Mithraic rituals and symbols, because really, they're way off. They did not know what we know now, and that's not really their fault, but it also does not mean it's worth reiterating their misunderstandings. Nonetheless, it is quite incredible how similar the two organizations can be, even if there is no genealogical connection between them. And personally, I like to think of it like finding out a friend of yours has the same birthday as you. I mean, it's pure happenstance, but it's so exciting. That's so cool. Or it's like when you and your buddy have like the exact same idea at the exact same time. It's coincidence, but man, is it cool. And I mean, really, when we compare Mithraism to Masonry, we're going to hit a lot of hurdles that make it so difficult to connect the two. I mean, how did the cave become the temple? Where did the slaying of the bull go? If Mithraism became Masonry, like, why do we get rid of that? When do we stop admitting slaves? Why were 4 degrees dropped, and the three that remained were reformed into a guild-like system? And did that happen gradually? Did one grade just drop at a time over centuries, or was it like all at once? When do we stop worshipping Mithras and just become a general society of men of faith? And what of the weird things we find in various Mithraea, such as like the winged lion-headed creature with the serpent coiled about its body while it's standing on a sphere? And this figure is usually called Aeon, or Ion, and is sometimes just called the lion-headed one. And no one's entirely certain what it is. Some have even dismissed it as something that belongs to another cult that is now lost, but at one time they held, you know, meetings in the same place as the Mithraea cults. Or what about the depictions of Cupid and Psyche in some Mithraea? Like, some things don't even make sense in Mithraicism, yet how are they to be reconciled with Masonry? Ultimately, there is no connection, and there probably shouldn't be one. Apart from there being no evidence, it's just problematic to try and connect the two societies. But it is nonetheless really interesting to see how similar the two organizations were. And in many ways, studying Mithraicism helps illuminate things in Masonry. I just find it so fascinating. Now, if you're interested in really diving into some serious academic research and archaeology on Mithraicism and the Mithraic cult, I highly recommend Roger Beck's book, The Religion of the Mithras Cult in the Roman Empire. Roger Beck also has a lot of papers on JSTOR, so if you have a Google account, go ahead and use your free articles and check them out. Franz Kuhmann's The Mysteries of Mithras is, well, it's a bit antiquated, but nonetheless, Kuhmann was one of the foremost researchers on understanding the Mithraic cults in his time. So his work is pretty valuable, even if it's a bit outdated. David Ulansey's The Origins of the Mithraic Mysteries is really fascinating for anyone interested in their cosmological ideologies and symbolism. Manfred Krauss's The Roman Cult of Mithras is also a classic. Not as outdated as Cumann, but nonetheless solid. So, if you'd like to dig in further, I highly recommend those texts and papers if you're just looking for more. Enjoy.
Well, there you have an extended segment of Masonic Mythbusters with Worshipful Brother Patrick Day in it, going over the similarities and differences between the cults of Mithras and Freemasonry, either ancient or modern. I loved the matter-of-factness, and typically Brother Patrick Day comes on the show and he essentially dismantles a lot of the awesome things we've heard about something. And that's not because Patrick wants to destroy, all of the cool things. It just so happens that when you do the research and you pull the history out of the past and you do the readings, certain things come to light. And many times, things are too good to be true and are quite unlikely. However, in this one, one finds, if nothing else, some awesome similarities between the two. Granted, a 600-year difference between them, but still, how amazing it is. Which perhaps alludes to this idea that there's something else as a foundation from which both of the organizations grew, even though they didn't touch. If we trace back far enough, surely we'll find origins of some of the practices, beliefs, and symbology contained within both of these systems in something else. What could it have been? And for that, I don't know. But those of you who have been listening to this show for a long time know that I have covered the cult of Mithras in probably 2 to 5 different episodes. We've read different articles about them. We've read the entries by Mackey. We've read entries by Pike. We've read things by Clausen, and even some excerpts from Time Magazine's Secret Societies of the Ages. And what is so exciting, I think, about this topic is that it is, as Patrick says, accessible more so than any other mystery tradition that exists. Eleusinian, Bacchus, the quote-unquote Egyptian mystery traditions, all of this. So it is fascinating. That's it for this week. I want to thank the producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners of the WCY Podcast. If you're curious on how you can help, visit our website at WCYpodcast.com and check out the various options available to you by clicking on Support the Show. For all of those in the Craftsman Plus group, I want to thank you for your engagement, and I'd love to know your thoughts on where these traditions could have come from. While they're separated, they still pull from similar ideologies. Is it a simple case of cultural mixing and amalgamations, and things get left over and put in the books and rediscovered by future generations who assign similar or new values to them? Or is it something else? Maybe something more fantastic? I'll let you all decide. Until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
WCY Media.
Hey, Z is not.